Hey everyone, and welcome to the Bitcoin Way podcast. I'm your host, Michael Jordan, and I appreciate you being here. I wrapped up a really fun conversation with Darren Epstein, who is actually a client of the Bitcoin Way. That's how we were introduced to him, but he has a very interesting story. This was a wide-ranging conversation we had. We talked a little bit about his experience with the Bitcoin Way. We talked about homeschooling kids, Austrian economics, really just about everything that you could possibly imagine. I think this is going to be a fun person to have on a periodic basis to just catch up and riff a little bit rather than do like a more topical theme-based episode. So I hope you enjoy my conversation with him as much as I did. All right, everyone. Like I said in the intro, I've got Darren here. Darren, welcome to the show.
Michael, thanks a lot. Great to be here.
I'm excited to talk to you. Like I was telling you offline, you know, there's so many directions we could take this. I think your background, your experience, some of your philosophies that have gone against the grain in recent years, I think are going to be fun for people to hear about and listen to. I bet there are going to be some good stories. Why don't you tell the story about how you were introduced to the Bitcoin Way, and then let's go back further and hear about your background, what led you to the Department of Defense, as you call it, the deep state, and any sort of background information would be fun.
Sure. So let's start with the Bitcoin Way, and I'll end up with that as well, because I think you have an amazing product and offer a great service, especially to, like we were talking about before, boomers who have maybe a steep learning curve to go through in order to be able to get the confidence and the skills developed to take self-custody. I mean, running a node, you know, if I'm 59 years old, and if you can get me to run a node, you can get anybody to run a node and have an air-gapped wallet and understand why the difference between that and having a USB connected. And if you go down the Bitcoin Way, they're going to walk you through all of that stuff. And the way I came across the Bitcoin Way was, I believe I heard an advertisement on the Bitcoin Standard podcast with Safe. Mm-hmm. And I also heard an interview with the CEO of the Bitcoin Way. And anything that's on Safe is probably my center of gravity in what my thinking is. I think he's distilled the ideas of libertarianism, of a free society, of Austrian economics, of Bitcoin, of self-custody, the Bitcoin standard, the fiat standard, the principles of economics. He's really distilled it for, I think, multi-generational approach to people being able to onboard into the Bitcoin space, which is really just an evolution of people who want to have a sound money, a free society. If you're really American, that's what you believe in. So I found the Bitcoin Way to be, and I used other entities in the interim. I was never much of a shitcoiner. So the origin story into how I found Bitcoin was I approached it, and when I talk to other people that I try to orange pill, and the rare occasion that I try to do that, because I don't think I've had much success, is I approached it as an investor. I didn't approach it as a libertarian. I didn't approach it as a techie. I was never a techie. I've always been, like I said, I was born in 1964. So my formative years, my 20s, would have been in the 80s, and we'll talk about my Army experience. But early on in my life, I understood that it was important to invest in the future. I didn't know anything about time preference. I didn't know anything about opportunity cost. It was merely that wealthy people around me, my grandfather in particular, took a portion of their money, put it aside. And back then, a portion of that would be in gold. A lot of it would be in equities. A lot of that would be in bonds, the traditional portfolio. And understanding that you're going to live for a long time in the United States, which, since we're on the US dollar standard, is in a better situation than most other economies, but you had to invest somehow for the future. And I had done that and been fairly successful, especially in my Army career. I always put separate money aside outside of the traditional 401k. I had a brokerage account. And I discovered early on through guys like Peter Lynch, you know, and Warren Buffett. I did the Motley Fool thing when that was a big thing, and onboarded into traditional stocks. But at the time, tried to figure out what was the thing, and this is going to be a big theme, is what was the biggest bang for the buck? What where could I put money? Where could that money grow? And where could I put it where I really didn't have to worry about it and check the statements every day? So for me, it basically distilled down to in the tech boom, and we hear a lot about the financial meltdown in 2000, the tech bubble in 2002, right? The financial crisis in 2008. We hear a lot about those things. I've taken a contrarian approach in that those were the best opportunities for me to invest because even though I lost some, when the 2008 financial crisis occurred, the majority of my portfolio was in Apple, Amazon, Netflix, and MasterCard. And I kind of created this little paradigm where I used Apple products, right? Buy the things that you use. What did I do with that product? I bought things through Amazon. How did I pay for it? I used my MasterCard. And where was entertainment at the time going? It was going from this blockbuster dynamic into Netflix. So in the 2008 crisis, when I was putting money into that portfolio in 2007, it began to look like this, right? So when you go in on that chart, much like if what you do, if you woke up this morning and you opened up River or whatever gives you the price, right? And you look at 57,000, there's a part in each of us, we have to be honest, there's a part in each of us that says, dang, right? But we know when you take that picture and you zoom back out and you take a macro view of that, we know where we've come in Bitcoin. And the same thing applied to these tech stocks back then. So in 2008, they were on sale. So I just kept buying and buying and buying and buying. And when everybody else was getting out and panicking, that portfolio grew. And then from 2008, I think those of us who paid more attention to what happened in the macro environment at that time began to realize that the whole paradigm was a bit of a Ponzi scheme. And so that eventually in 2008, of course, Bitcoin comes along much after that. And my first exposure to Bitcoin was because I've lived in Japan for a long time, is the Mt. Gox thing. So I looked at this as a pariah. And I managed to hold on to a lot of my equities over time. And then around maybe 2018, 2019, when I read the Bitcoin Standard, it really stuck out to me what a Ponzi scheme this thing is. And then right after that, and it was in Japan at the time. So we saw what was going to happen with the COVID coronavirus thing. We kind of had a little bit of a lead time in Japan because if you remember, a lot of the first news of this was on that cruise ship, the Diamond Princess. And so we just got a lead on that. And something told me, my spidey senses were ready to understand that something disruptive was going to happen that could greatly affect our livelihoods, our jobs, political stability of the international environment. And as an investor, I started to get for the one of the first times in my life, I started to get nervous. And thankfully, around 2019, because we built this house that we live in Japan, I had to be cash heavy. So I cashed out of my portfolio like in October of 2019. So I didn't get a taste of the March 2020 dip because of the coronavirus stuff. And then when the market went down 40%, your inclination is your scalp starts to get itchy because you want to get back in because you're approaching it in the way that much like, and we'll talk about this later, much like hodlers do now, right? You wake up 57,000, it's $57,000, whatever, if we price it in fiat today, Bitcoin. But when you and guys like you and I wake up, even though I'm not particularly in a paradigm where I'm allocating more fiat to Bitcoin, just where I am in my investment profile, I look at it this morning, I'm like, dang, I got a crush buy in River or wherever because because it's on sale and it just makes sense and we know where this thing is going. So I'll start off with that
Yeah, I
and
know. I did the same thing today. So
then
I can
yeah.
relate. Well, the CEO of Bitcoin decided to do a flash sale. That's always a fun
Yeah,
day.
that's exactly right. Yeah, he's got that kind of power.
Okay, so tell me about throughout this time, like where did your career, I guess in government specifically, I think is what's maybe going to be most interesting and most relevant to your distrust of these sorts of institutions. Where did you enter it? You have a military background, worked in the Department of Defense, it sounds like. What was that career trajectory for you?
Yeah, so and you know, Michael, what I find now as I travel, and I think an upside to being a boomer in a way, if you're, let me rephrase that. An upside to being somebody who, because there are downsides, someone who is self-aware, right? We all know the downsides, right? There are times where you just want to be a mushroom growing under a log like everybody else, and not creating this unnecessary stress for yourself, right? And I had heard a story. It was at, I'm a big World War II or military history fan in the World at War, where this guy relates that in 1939, he's a German guy, when Hitler's coming to power, and he's studying in England, and he goes back to Germany to visit his girlfriend. And when he shows up, he finds himself in a rally where Hitler's speaking, and he's kind of like that guy, you know, you've seen that photo where the guy's standing like this, and he's looking around and going like, oh my God, I picked like the worst time ever to come back. And I think I've almost spent my entire life being like that in some way. And I don't attribute it to maybe a great awakening, but I think if you're self-aware, you kind of, if you're reflective about your childhood, I grew up in the Boston, you know, the North Shore of Boston. So the backdrop to that at that time was the Revolutionary War and what led up to that. So to me, I was always imbued with this spirit that when something went wrong, when government didn't respond to the will, whim of the people, or the wills of the wishes of the people, rather, that there was this compelled reaction that the people must take in order to defend or progress their liberty. That was just ingrained in me. And so the folks who were on Breed's Hill, who, you know, gave their, and I, you know, listen to your all of the your previous podcasts, and I think it was on the Conservative Case for Bitcoin podcast where you mentioned about folks sacrificing their lives for your liberty. To me, because I'm so dispirited by American military history, in reality, the only war that really captures that for me is the American Revolution, where people really fought for this principle. And somehow that stayed in my mind. And the backdrop to my youth was we were involved in Vietnam. I remember my father sitting me down. I was 12 years old on the bed watching the fall of Saigon and not really comprehending, you know, should I support the folks who protested the war? Should I support the folks that were caught up in the war? We had friends that were, or you know, acquaintances who were killed in Vietnam. And it was very clear to me during that epoch that it was the poor working class folks that bore the brunt of it, and that the elite, upper echelon of society didn't pay that price. And so I think those seeds were ingrained in me. However, when Ronald Reagan came into power, you know, I had this conservative arc where I was from liberal Massachusetts. My parents were probably, you know, Scoop Jackson, conservative Democrats. I think my mother voted for Jimmy Carter. My father voted for Gerald Ford. And when Ronald Reagan came along and started talking about, you know, the
Government
greatness of
is the
America,
problem. Yeah, and government is the problem. And
that's right. And that appealed to me. That's when I started becoming aware of Milton Friedman and Friedrich Hayek and these bigger ideas. And ironically, I was at university at the time, and I did very poorly in high school, so poorly that I had to do an additional year at prep school. And the only reason why I point these things out is because it's almost like, and I don't know if you're religious, but anyone who reads the Bible and becomes religious understands that the Bible isn't this thing that you thump. It's not a collection of great stories that you're saying, oh, hey, believe in this, the good news. The good news is at the end. But when you're going through it, it's a litany of people with extreme problems and parables of how these people face those challenges and get through that problem set by relying on a higher power. Like, you know, Moses, no one, who'd want to be Moses? He's questioning himself the whole time. So as you're going kind of through this process of your own development and your self-awareness, you're kind of aware that there's something better out there. A visionary comes along. So you think Ronald Reagan, who ended up spending just as much money as any other Democrat and not being that great hope, But when I did end up at university, ironically, as we see what's happening on campuses today, is I went to a liberal university, University of Rochester, but we were taught the classics. I had feminist teachers, but I had a semester of Milton, John Milton, with a feminist teacher who didn't say, "This is an angry dead white man, ignore him." We read the literature and took out of that what was culturally important about John Milton. I had a semester of Twain. I had a semester of Shakespeare. I had a semester of Chaucer. I studied in England for a summer to bring all those things together. And that cultural development for me was key to my understanding, because I had well, classical and scriptural backgrounds, and also political philosophy. So we read, I had one semester of Notes on Debates of the Federal Constitution, James Madison, where you go through, so you're reading the Federalist Papers, you understand these systems, and you understand the debates that are happening at the time. So I think I was well armed, ironically, in this liberal institution that gave me the ideas of individual liberty, individual freedom, what does it mean to be independent? And also, like I said, classical and scriptural backgrounds, a semester of Old Testament. So you're really able to kind of understand that it's not just you in your youth that's wandering down this meandering path, but that there's these tenets that you can believe in. And that served me well in an academic sense. However, my academic production in university wasn't anything to write home about. So although I attended for 4 years, I dropped out and became a waiter at TGI Fridays for a while. And then once I did that for a while, it sank in. I was probably 22 and 1988. And it began to sink in that I could end up like doing that for the rest of my life. And not to disparage anybody who does that work, because I admire the working class more than anyone. But I just kind of expected more of myself. And so I approached my entry into the army as this thing that would, we have a saying in the military, get you out of Dodge. What is the thing that's going to get me out of my hometown, that's going to prevent me from, having a child at, a young age without experiencing life? And just like Odysseus or any other great traveler, I wanted to experience the great journey, the hero's journey. And to me, the entry point was the army. And the army served me well. I enlisted in 1988, and then I think the army was the only institution, ironically, I don't think it's this way today, that doesn't judge you when you come in, based on your pedigree, maybe like a university does. And the army is nothing about, or the military at the time, not today, was nothing but opportunity. So if you wanted to go in, you wanted to apply yourself, if you wanted to go to airborne school, which I did, and I enlisted infantry. Then I became an officer. I went through officer candidate school and went field artillery and volunteered basically for every school that was available. I served a tour in Germany. I was in the first Iraq War. I served for 5 years in Korea. I spent 20 years in Japan. I think maybe seven of those active duty. I was able to command an artillery battery, multiple launch rocket system in Korea. And all those experiences were very positive in my interactions with ordinary soldiers, with carrying out the mission of what I thought was defending America, waving the flag. I mean, look, when they play the national anthem, I would well up, in tears. And I don't think that sentiment in my inner being is dead. I don't think that will ever be dead, but it's certainly diminished. And I think when I express my views to people, they take it as being, an uber libertarian and an anarcho-capitalist. I don't care anything about the red, white, and blue and all those things. I'm not trying to make it that extreme. However, if the flag doesn't stand for liberty, then what does it stand for? I mean, does it st is it a geographic area? And does that geographic area now include Ukraine? Does it include, there were literally times when I was in Korea, like I said, I spent 5 years, and I'd be out in the, in the woods playing army in Korea, and understanding that there were, political tensions on the Korean Peninsula, meaning that there's 50% of Koreans don't want us there. Like the farmer, we're going through farmers' farmland, and they don't want us there. Maybe there's about 50% that do want us there. And it began to occur to me, who's paying for our presence and why? I'm from Boxford, Massachusetts. Why am I in Korea, 50 years after the Korean War, and ready to implement this defense of Korea? And by the same token, when I went to the first Gulf War as well, when we deployed there and I saw all the stuff kind of take place, I was in a unit that wasn't deploying. And I was the type of guy that I was going to get myself there by hook or by crook. It's just like, if you ever played sports, right? You don't want to practice and not play the game. Everybody wants to play the game. If you're a real warrior, you want to play the game. So if you're in the army, you want to get in. If you're, I think, kind of if you're worth a shit. And I was a true believer at the time. So, and I couldn't have all my friends go and then not try to do everything to go. That's what you do when you're young and stupid. I did that. But I think in the first Gulf War, I really started to look around at how it was mismanaged, questioned, could we have done things differently? We were under the burning oil wells for about a month. We caused a lot of great destruction and I think more suffering than any good that we did. So that accumulated experience. And then also later, serving in Japan, where I start to question, why should American kids be on the hook? And they are. And I wrote a piece at Mises.org that I can give you information about, that lays out all of the treaties that the United States is burdened by, where our children are signed up. I've got two boys, 16-year-old and an 11-year-old. They have not had the ability to even open bank accounts, but they are signed up to go and defend countries like Japan, countries like Korea, where we have mutual security treaties. Their tax dollars are going to that effort. They have no say in that matter. And I was somebody who volunteered to do it, but then the greater question is, and my children are aware of these facts. The majority of Americans aren't aware of those facts. And even when Congress goes through and starts to vote for additional aid to Ukraine, additional aid to Israel, all of those things that are causing unrest in the United States right now, it shouldn't be any surprise to the American people, even though, they don't pay attention to it. They're watching, they're more concerned about whether the Bruins are winning or whether the Celtics are winning or whatever, any other team that I follow. I saw some thing on X where I guess 700,000 people went and attended the NFL draft in Detroit. Detroit. I mean, you would think 700,000 people might go on the streets to protest what it's
Anything
like to live in
happening right
Detroit.
now? Yeah. That is.
So, yeah.
Actually saw a meme just today, and it was like a painting of the American Revolution. I guess it was, the Redcoats and some of the Patriots in the streets firing at each other, and it said, 1774, whatever, 2% tax, and then it was 2024, 40% tax, and it was a bunch of people just staring at their phones. It's like we've just become so complacent. And
And that's exactly it. That's exact. And that, Michael, because and I know by having listened to your previous shows is and that's the burden, the burden on people like us. And I think that's why we developed an instant affinity, right? How long have I known you? And I'm having a deeper conversation with you than I would with my brother, who I'm not very close with because he's more in that. And I think most Bitcoiners probably experience this where they're the lone person that's thinking about Bitcoin. They're the
it can be lonely. It can be lonely.
it is extreme. It's extremely. Don't make me be the white pill, dude. Don't make me be the white pill, but because I have this tendency, like if you're the black pill, I'll go white. And maybe we can save that. But I do have hope because I am very much invigorated by the energy that's brought to this. And I'm very reluctant to use the term community because I think this thing that we're referring to a community right now is more disjointed than we care to point out at this time. The one thing that we have in common is Bitcoin. And I think there is a saying in Bitcoin that Bitcoin has no heroes, and it's almost like what we talked about when we were talking about Reagan, right? Politics, leftists want their heroes. They need their Mao. They need their their Stalin. They need their Hitler, ironically leftist. They need their Obama, and anybody else who challenges that is somehow a Trump lover or whatever category. And I've always argued that I don't attach myself to any figure because, having lived 59 years, I am prepared to be disappointed. And that's kind of a meme that I have in my Bitcoin journey, is be prepared to be disappointed. And if you are, you kind of won't be let down. And I think a lot of us in this community are a little bit, savvy like that. When you follow guys like Vijay Boyapati and Stefan Lavera, folks I think who have a Guy Swan, folks who have a finger on the pulse in, people that we probably listen to. I heard your show with Nico. I think Nico's fantastic. I think what he and Opti do on Simply Bitcoin, and that's how I start my day. I mean, they just get, and the thing is, it's the young, Nico did a rant the other day. I don't want to call it a rant,
I think
but he
he'd
was
probably
talking
call it
about,
a rant. Don't, I don't think he'll offend him.
I had never heard him more angry. But when he was talking
Oh,
about how the
I.
bankers got it right, the bankers, swindled everybody out of trillions of dollars. You look at what Congress is doing, and they only get bailouts. And then who does the government choose to go after? The Samurai wallet guys. Anybody, and like I said, I know, and this is the reason why I'm reluctant to use the term community, because in the Bitcoin space or whatever it is, when you see on X the reactions, people are going to, huddle up, well, the Samurai wallet guy shouldn't have been doing this. And other folks are, well, this is attack on nodes and self-custody. I'm more in the latter camp, where I just think I don't trust government to be able to do anything. And I don't understand what the role that government thinks it has, to protect us against, the evil samurai guys, or, now it's the new legislation in Congress, the anti-Semitism protection or whatever that is, more protection daddy from the government, which is going to limit free speech. And I think these things are all connected. So I'm very careful when I think of a Bitcoin community. I think what gives me hope is the individuals that you connect with, like the folks that I did in the Bitcoin way, and back to the Bitcoin way in a bit. I think that's what makes the Bitcoin way different than anything that I've experienced so far, is people have skin in the game, and they'll tell you their skin in the game, right? The people that I work with, as I go through, we have conversations like this. It's not, it's not all, setting up nodes and Lightning wallets and et cetera. It's we go off in tangents, and it's because, the CEO had his experience in Lebanon, and he saw a society disintegrate. Another person that's in your environment sacrificed his career over, personal bodily choices, which is a choice that I had to make also in DOD, when they mandated a procedure. I didn't go along with the procedure. I was one out of 174 people. Actually, there were two out of 174 people where we said, no, we're not going to do the procedure, and everybody else giddily complied. So we're talking about people who have master's degrees, right, who don't have the ability to think critically. And that's why, at some point, the Department of Defense, and I'm going to write more extensively about this for Mises, n needs to come to an end. But we'll touch that at some other time.
No, you hit on so many interesting points. And I think a lot of what you're talking about are the things that I think about, like in my per and just a few examples in my personal life. Again, like I grew up in a relatively conservative home. My parents didn't talk politics. They didn't talk about who they were voting for, at least not at any length. I probably picked up on it, through osmosis. But there's a part of me that can't let go of the American ideal. Like I still stand and put my hand over my heart for the national anthem, and I'm grateful for my country. But I think what I over the last couple of years in my Bitcoin journey, I've come to many of the same conclusions that you came to, I think, much longer ago, and that is, it's an acknowledgement and appreciation for the ideals, not for what we have, because the country that I mean, The founding fathers are rolling over in their graves, and they have been for a long time, right? I mean, it's not even just like a recent thing, but it's getting really, really ugly. You talked about the Bitcoin. It's not really a Bitcoin community. It's because it's like, actually, I posted something on X today or yesterday, in the last few days, and it was like, anytime something even semi-eventful happens in the world, this is Bitcoin Twitter. And it's like this GIF of like these people charging at each other, like going to war against each other. It's like almost nothing can happen, and or something significant like the samurai guy. It's like you would think we would all be rallying for the same thing if it was a community. Instead, like we're beating the hell out of each other. It's just it's wild. But the you know what though, these are like the things that you come to recognize. Like you I think this is what's so interesting about Bitcoin. The deeper down the rabbit hole you go, the more clear your thinking, your philosophy becomes for yourself, right? You become more aware of the things that you prioritize, that you care about, what an ideal world and family and life looks like for you. And so I understand that emotions get high and people get heated. I'm hopeful that we don't defeat ourselves before we really get lift off. And I think that's maybe the thing. Not that I'm expressing doubt over the future of Bitcoin, but we can do we could really delay this inevitable success of Bitcoin if we can't figure out the best way of working and coordinating, And that's not, hopefully that doesn't sound too kumbaya, but practically speaking, we can do ourselves a lot of damage, and I just hope we don't. So, I don't know if there wasn't exactly a question there. That was a rant more than anything. But yeah, if you have any comments.
No. And you look, that's a, it's a beautiful statement. And I think we knew at the beginning of this is the nature of this particular episode and where it would go. Oh, Pellegrino, man, that's 'cause I
You
have
got it?
that in here
Oh,
with
man.
lime. Yeah, baby.
I love it.
So, and I completely agree 100% on many fronts. And like you said, so I often hear people talking about, and Nico refers to it almost every show, The Sovereign Individual. And there are these essential books that we all need to read: Bitcoin Standard, Bullish Case for Bitcoin, Bitcoin Evangelism. I really like Brian DeMint. He was on Simply Bitcoin today. And he's a guy that, you reach out on X. He's a jujitsu guy. He's a father. People start talking about, well, now we're at the now they fight you stage, right? In government coming after you, et cetera, et cetera. My fear is, and this is what I think I may bring to the community as I venture forth and develop my own media presence, is I do have military training. So I was an infantryman, artilleryman, and then I ended up as an army strategist. The last job I had in the army was a speechwriter for the 4-star in the Republic of Korea. And so this idea of how we create, we call it in the military strategic communications. There's also information operations, right? So information operations is what the Department of Defense, the military industrial complex, the CIA, the intelligence agencies, that's what they're conducting against us on Twitter, right? That's information operations. When they put out a statement, when they coordinate through the media, that's what they're doing. It's no secret. Now, I have never been involved in information operations. Normally, the type of information operations that I'm involved in was in a planning sense against foreign adversaries. And I retired from the army in 2010, really before you could really see this stuff manifesting. And just like the color revolutions in Ukraine, all the things that have been documented, open source, nothing from my personal experience or for any classified information that I've been privy to. But this idea of strategic communications as well, and although the government does a terrible job at it, right? When you look at the White House press secretary, when you look at what is that, Admiral Kirby at the Department of Defense, I mean, they get ratioed out the ass on Twitter. So, and that'll bring me to another point later. But this idea of, and this is what we need, and again, in this space, community, whatever we're calling this thing, is that we have to have some sort of, when you're a lieutenant or you're a captain, you're in the army, you're in charge of troops, We used to have a battle book, and it's something that you could keep in your cargo pocket. And it had all the information on all your soldiers and their height and weight, their weapons qualification. You had information on firing data for the weapon systems that you had. You had these. Now we probably have these things on tablets, but I'm still, a boomer in that regard, where I like to take notes and have my kind of plan of action. But we have to have this strategic,
I'm the same
it's
way.
like
I've
this.
got
Michael might say something that I
20
have to write
notebooks out
down.
there. Yep.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, and I was doing that when I was traveling, and I was getting shit from my buddy who's a successful orange pill story. He's an airline pilot for American Airlines, great guy, and he also sacrificed because they were going to make him get the vax at his last job as a pilot, and we had communicated openly, and this is you talk about a kumbaya moment, right? We were going through this at the same time, and I had put in a re religious exemption. I grew up Jewish, but I'm not. Yeah, I am where I am, and so I have a non-traditional view of Israel, and not to get political. And then my buddy happens to be Muslim, and so we were going through this journey together. We met in jujitsu on the mat. And when you meet somebody on the mat and you click, it's just like kind of when you meet in the Bitcoin community. And so he was calling me, he was stressing out, hey, I gotta do this application and I don't know what to do on the religious exemption thing. I said, okay, hey, let me send you all the stuff that I did. So I sent it in digits, send the background stuff. Basically, all he did was change find all Jewish, replace with Muslim or Islam. And basically submitted that, and it was successful. So it shows you that we can bridge gaps in or these theoretical gaps if our humanity comes through. And then it happens that when people have that type of interaction, he's the type of person that's open to Bitcoin. Of course, it just always seems that way. And he got orange pilled, and he went and he started buying. He opened up a River account. He'll probably be coming the way of the Bitcoin way as he starts to build out. He's ready to do hard wallet. He's ready to do Node. He's really ready to do all these things. And the other people that I have that are friends, I have a couple other friends in the Bitcoin space, and they're all my friend in Arizona is they're very religious, homeschooled their children, have five fantastic children, and they take risks every day in order to ensure the safety of their kids and their financial future. So I'm extremely white-pilled when it comes to what the future holds, but I do believe, I just described a couple of disparate nodes that we have to have some sort of common strategy where we understand. And I don't want to get it down to talking points, et cetera, et cetera. Talking points can be a bad thing, but talking points can be a good thing. For example, a talking point in our space needs to be whenever any entity is attacked by the state that could weaken the prospects of Bitcoin becoming a universal sovereign decentralized currency, a peer-to-peer cashless payment system, according to the tenets of the white paper, that we have to think very strongly about defending that enterprise, whether it's on cypherpunk terms, whether it's on monetary terms, whether it's on political terms. All these things that brought people from disparate venues into this space, we need to have a uniform, allied approach to understand where we are in the space. And I'm currently looking for, so it's, you talked about in the conservative case for Bitcoin, the founding documents. And so how old are you, Michael? Do you
I'm
mind me asking?
34.
34. Oh, to be 34 again. I'm 59. So,
It
and so
feels, I feel old now. I got three
Well,
kids.
and the thing is, you are you're intellectually advanced beyond, the average 34-year-old. And I think the same applies to me as a 59-year-old. So I don't look at it in terms of, I'm getting very skeptical. I jokingly refer to boomers, et cetera, et cetera. What I find is, there was a friend of mine in university. We were studying in England during the summer, and he said, when we would, flippantly say, well, the English are like this, so the Irish are like this, or the Japanese or whatever. We got it down to there are good people everywhere and there are assholes everywhere. And so It doesn't matter what your age is. Like I said, my best friend, one of my best friends, the guy I met through jujitsu, I think he's 37. And so, sometimes when we're having these discussions, I have to stop and think, well, wait a second, I'm talking to somebody, who's a couple decades younger than me. It wasn't really until my late 40s that I started to become disillusioned with the Constitution. And that's mainly because I started reading things like Lysander Spooner. I did a deep dive. Was it Thomas DiLorenzo, who works at Mises, who wrote The Problem with Lincoln, right? Really kind of deconstructing these ideas as to getting into the revisionist view of history. And even Michael Saylor talked about recently, Seyfedin sent him a bunch of books. I think it was like a stack of physical books that Michael keeps by his bedside. And you know him. He's just this, he'll get a bunch of them on audio and listen to the stuff. And you can tell when you see his public presentations, he's filling in more details, right? He's going in different directions. You can see his growth. And when you read Murray Rothbard's Conceived in Liberty, it's probably that thick. I don't know because I read it on Kindle. He points out again, like we talked about before in the Bible, that really the American story is fraught with surprises. It isn't this story about everybody, our ancestors came and they burned to be free and,
It's broken people making their way.
that's right. And the tendency for humans to want to tyrannize other humans is strong, whether it's in the name of religion, whether it's in the name of ethnicity, whether it's in the name of dispossessing the, native population off the land. And again, these aren't political statements because the same thing, the Mongols did the same thing. So I'm not,
It's been going on for millennia.
that's right. As long as humans wanted things that other people had. And really that brings us back to Bitcoin, right? Is that, the government is beginning to understand that this thing has long-term value, right? That it may supplant the system that they're using to monopolize the international economy. And they are, some are, not all. They're becoming aware of this. They're becoming deathly afraid, and they have to clamp down on it. And it's not necessarily an organized or a uniform or an intellectually thought out approach. It's like somebody swinging. You're in a bar fight and they're just swinging, and they may hit you. But if we bring it back down to the founding documents, everything that I just said, and what I do is at least once a year, and I did it the other day, is I highly recommend people take out the Declaration of Independence and read it to yourself aloud. And you make it not very far, right? So when in the course of human events, I'll just read a paragraph, it becomes necessary for one people to dissolve the political bands which have connected them with another, and to assume among the powers of the earth the separate and equal station to which the laws of nature and of nature's God entitle them, a decent respect of the opinions of mankind requires that they should declare the causes which impel them to the separation. That and I mean it
That is very powerful post Orange Pill, because like the last, so I've actually got all the founding documents sitting on my bedside table, and but I haven't read them in a few years. I haven't read them in the last 2 years since I've gone down this on this Bitcoin journey. That's incredibly powerful hearing as a Bitcoiner. Like, I mean, they got it right. Not that
They got it
all,
right.
not that all the decisions and determinations for how to set up government. And if you're an anarcho-capitalist, then you think any government is bad. Like, you can argue about that all day, but in principle, like what they were pursuing, I mean, they nailed it. And I think we're maybe at that pivotal point in history once again. And I think my question for you is, and this is something I sort of alluded to prior to hopping on. I'm curious to hear your thoughts, and you're way more prepared than most people. You sent me some notes. How do you think this plays out? Well, hang on. But before you answer that question, because another thing you said, and you sort of started to highlight it, was we talk about then they fight you as though it's just this phase that we go through and then we win, but you only win if you fight back. And it was, I think, the point you made. Like, you don't win just because, right? Just because you have this good idea or because you're smarter or whatever. You win because you fight the good fight, and you have the greater value prop and you're more prepared, and anything else that you would add to that from a, as with a military background. So I'm curious, assuming the Bitcoin community space, us Bitcoiners, fight back, what do you view that fighting looking like? Is this, I mean, does it turn into the French Revolution? Is this the peaceful revolution? There's so many takes on this, I think, and potential outcomes. And again, obviously, I am in no way an advocate for violence. My hope, I love my country. I love the principles upon which my country was founded, and I want this to be a hopeful, joyous occasion by which we enter into a Bitcoin standard. So I'd be curious to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, I mean that's the billion-dollar question, and I've thought about it at great length, and it kind of gets me into this circular logic. But and I think it's probably the like one of the last notes that I put on my notes, but I'll get to it now. Is the thing that white pills me is that I found with my interactions with Bitcoin people, I think it was Safe or a bunch of people have said Safe said it. I think Michael Saylor said it. That there's no intelligent argument against Bitcoin, right? And I've had these interactions with people where I have mentioned it in passing, right? And folks will, tell me it's only good for terrorism and for criminality, et cetera. And then I'll probe a little bit more, and they'll say, "Well, I've looked into it." And then I'll ask them, "Okay, well, what have you read?" And then you kind of go into that. You got them. You got them. You just cornered them. What have you read? Well, what do you mean? Well, have you read the Bitcoin Standard? Are you aware of it? No. Have you read Bullish Case for Bitcoin Evangelism? Layered money, broken money, any of these things, fiat food, any of these things that we find ourselves in this space, have you done the research? They're not going to outstudy us. And you look at a guy like Michael Saylor, and again, I'm not holding up anybody to be a champion, because over time, these guys might find it easier to take an escape hatch. That's just human nature. Because he's a multi-billionaire, he's in a different position than I am. I do think his signal is valuable, and I'm banking on that the majority of smart people in this space, in the overall transition from government-controlled money to decentralized money, is that the smart people are all on our side. So when I see people like, if I'm scrolling through X and I don't do it that much. And I see, Jack Mahler's on there, I mean, he looks so young, right? And then I listened to what he said at I watched most of the speeches at Madeira. I pay attention to Lawrence Lepard as well, because he's kind of more from my generational take. But the enthusiasm and what Jack has done at Strike, what people are trying to do as they build out these platforms and looking at alternatives, I understand. Look, it's super small now, but I think what it's going to take, like you said, we in the military we call kinetic or non-kinetic. The people who are going to make it kinetic, and this is a very important point, it's not us. We want the peaceful, decentralized revolution. We want to be able to choose healthy diets. We want to be able to support local ranchers and eat healthy food that comes from that natural regenerative farming. We want to be able to exercise and get sun and love our children and homeschool and do all these things that not as a form of protest, but because we have skin in the game. We have skin in the game to each other, however we define it, whether it's a community. I have skin in the game because now, Michael Jordan's my friend, right? And I have an opinion that I form. It's a friendly node. If you were ever, near where I live and you called me up and you said, "Hey, I need a place to crash," you're in. You got it. And so it's gonna have to be this type of thing where does it and the Bitcoin way is thinking through these problem sets actively with the Panama relocation program, something that I'm looking at, whether it's Panama. I think Central America is a good location. But whenever we do that, what we're going to have to think through, I think, and like you said, I'm an anarcho-capitalist in that, yeah, I'm very skeptical of government. It doesn't mean that I'm against governance, right? So self-governance. So like if you and I and a few other folks were in a neighborhood, right, and you knocked on my door, "Hey, can you watch my kids? Because we got it." "Yep, I got it." "Hey, Dada, I'm gonna be gone for a week. Can you take my trash out?" "Yeah." "Hey, there's some suspicious looking guys around the corner. Let's, strap up and go check it out." You have to develop these plans where there's going to be a physical security aspect to it. There's digital security aspects to it. We don't have to all agree on political issues as well, but we do have to agree on the big things like life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, that you leave me alone. I'm, you know, what happens behind someone's closed doors is up to them, as long as they're not violating the non-aggression principle, as long as they're not violating children. And I happen to be more in a religious camp, in that because I put so much value on human life and human sovereignty, I just personally think that comes from God, and that I had kind of a journey when I went through discovering that my job was basically to plan how to kill people around the world. I have no inherent animosity towards North Koreans. They have a terrible government. Well, so do we. I'm not saying I would rather live in North Korea. Not at all. Like you said, I love the United States. I have hope for it. I don't have an inherent bias against Chinese or you know. And then you think over time who have been our allies in the past, who have been our adversaries in the past. It all changes, and so it's going to require effort. It's going to require due diligence. It's going to require every one of us to bring whatever we have to the fight. But we're not going to be the ones that choose to get violent and aggressive. I think you can see through the campus protests and other things, the monopoly of violence exists with the state. You can see what's happening in Gaza, without making any political, you know, statement whatsoever.
Just an
When
observation.
humanity, that's right. And when humanity suffers, and that's where I am on all sorts of social issues. And there's a leadership aspect to that in, I think, in the army, although the army, you know, now violates it. If you're not willing to do it, then you shouldn't be able to ask your subordinates to do it. I wouldn't be willing to kill a child. I wouldn't be willing to torture somebody that we captured. That's just, you know, inherent. I believe that's in the Ten Commandments. And I think a lot of folks in this Bitcoin space come at what we're dealing with in the societal transition. And look, and I'm kind of
No, hey, this
meandering,
is great. No.
but what I'll say is so again, like I said, I'll always go in this black pill direction, and then for some reason I'm ultimately positive about the enterprise. Because here's the thing: what if we were having this discussion and it was just like a political, like I don't know, Daily Wire or something that is complete nonsense and non-valuable. Or, you know, I love Joe Rogan. I think he's fantastic. I think he's got a lot of good guests, but you know, it's more of a riff, and you know, no one's really ever coming to a point. But we're talking about all these things that we identify as problems today, and we've agreed there always been problems throughout history. But now we have this thing. We have Bitcoin. We have this thing that is a decentralized digital currency, peer-to-peer payment system, that if we do it, if we get this right, and if we get the on-ramps right, if we get the off-ramps right, if we know how to store it, if we know how to self-custody it, right? If we understand how to, you know, if we're working on layer two and layer three, and how to get payments and settlement to happen more quickly, we know, right? We're convinced that this thing is going to work. You know, Michael Saylor was a naysayer. I was a naysayer at the beginning before I started to look. When you start to look at this thing, you're like, okay, the thing works, and we have the thing. Now the question is, how much skin are we willing to put in the game, right, to ensure? Because it's not the thing, right? Bill Clinton used to have this saying, we're going to ensure that there's a computer in every classroom, and everybody's going to be, you know, educated, because you know, you're going to have a computer. And when I was a kid, the meme was, hey, you know, television is going to hearken in a new era of education for the masses, right? You're going to have,
Oh,
so, you know,
wow.
you're going to have PBS, right? You're going to have Sesame Street and all this stuff. How did that work out?
Yeah.
The fact that we talked about it, you know, the first time I turned on this mic was for this podcast. It was sitting upstairs for a couple years. Unless you use the thing, right? Unless you use your mind, unless you dedicate something of yourself into the enterprise, the thing ain't going to happen. And that does bring us back to, why are you in the space that you are right now? What brought you to the Bitcoin way? And I know, and that's how we met, right? Like-minded people were thinking through these problem sets. These things might keep us up at night, right? You see the Samurai wallet thing, and you start to question, and you watch macro happen in the Hong Kong ETF, and you look at grumblings in Russia about eliminating this, and what is the impact of the BRICS going to have on this, and Congress's latest legislation, and the spiraling debt, all these things that macro has an effect on this thing we call Bitcoin. But the thing is, we've got the Bitcoin, and we can't screw it up. And so, do I think it's going to be a violent transition? I think the government's going to make that choice. I think they're going to make life difficult. I think we may have to move. It may become a jurisdictional specific thing. I don't know, but I have hope.
Hey, just a quick break and we'll get back to the show. But I want to introduce you to our very first sponsor of the Bitcoin Way podcast, Satoshi Coffee Company. Satoshi Coffee, sats.coffee is the URL. They make high quality, fresh roasted coffee, and they even put the block number to show proof of work on each bag. If you're watching on YouTube, you can see that. I'm not a coffee snob, but I'm sort of picky about what I do enjoy. And this Satoshi blend, which is one of their more popular blends, is incredible. They also have a blend from El Salvador and a couple of others. I'd highly recommend you trying out all of them. But the cool thing about Satoshi Coffee Company is they are Bitcoin only and only accept Bitcoin as payment. And as a Bitcoin Way podcast listener, you get 6.9% off if you go to sats.coffee and enter code TBW69. Again, Satoshi Coffee Company, sats.coffee. Check them out. Support Bitcoin only companies like Satoshi Coffee Company.
Yeah, something my dad used to say is, God gives us the tools, and it's our job to make use of them. And I think you're spot on with this. So I guess my question, one of the things you mentioned offline is like your mission, or a piece of your mission, I think, is bringing or turning boomers into Bitcoin maxis. So you made this point earlier, and I think it is so easy to just categorize boomers as a particular thing, and like that's all boomers are sort of the same. And obviously they're not, because I don't talk to a lot of people who are 59, I think you said, that speak like this, right? I mean, most people. But and so the way I sort of blanket classify boomers is not in any negative way, but like my dad, for example, owned a small business, did well for himself, provided for his family, raised like I literally live on a compound with my brother and sister and my brother's family. Like we all live within 200 yards of each other. Like that's how close we are.
Sweet.
So like we've kind of got this great setup. We're gonna be homeschooling all of our kids, like that whole thing. So
Oh.
it's cool. But I guess what I the more I learned about Bitcoin, the more I view boomers as they've benefited so much over the last, call it 40 years, from the existing system. Not all, not equally. But I live in an area, I live west of St. Louis, Missouri, and it's we have pockets of more affluent neighborhoods, and then pockets of, just kind of middle, upper middle class, I guess you'd probably say. And most of the people I'm surrounded by have benefited so much from the system. They were just able to park a bit into saving, not savings, into, their, S&P index fund. And over the last 30 years of working, have such an abundance of wealth relative to anything that Gen Z could possibly imagine it, at that age. Like, and you look at some of the data, it's like the median income versus median cost of a house back in 1965 versus today, and it's like 3x or something, it's some crazy number. Like it's just unaffordable today for most people unless they've had that wealth to keep up and surpass inflation over the years. So in light of that, in light of having an audience of boomers that I would just say not all, but broadly have that privilege, and I hate the word privilege because I think it's got like a it's got a bad connotation. It's got a left-wing connotation now that I don't like. But how do you reach them? Like, what's the message that compels them into something like Bitcoin when they when many in the West in particular don't absolutely need it.
You know, and I think what you just said, that last sentence, that, because I struggle with this, I think that last sentence was extremely important, Michael, and that's because you used the term West, right? And so what, look, this thing is going, and let's say the West makes the on-ramps and off-ramps so onerous that it's just not worth having. If they make, you know, if they do unrealized capital gains on just holding Bitcoin, right? And we're just getting smoked. Not only is that going to force a lot of us to in this space to move, but that's going to be despite the fact that the billions of folks who are out there who are using Bitcoin who are unbanked, right? Who it's their first on-ramp into a global financial system, or let's just keep it as a local financial system of what's happening in El Salvador, but you're going to see it's happening in Africa and Nigeria. We all know this in our space. And I think that there's just going to be such a tipping point where and I have hope for those areas where you're going to see, look, if you go back to, let's say, 1950, right? Korean War breaks out, June 1950, right? 50 to 53, Seoul is recaptured numerous times. The country was devastated, and Korea was a backwater of a nation anyway. Understand the United States intervened, United Nations intervened, pushed the Chinese and North Koreans back up north, and then you've got this external investment as well. But the industry and the intellectual capacity of the South Koreans is something to marvel at. Same thing with the Japanese. You know, the East Asians have something, right? The Chinese, look at the economy. They're the number two economy in the world. Japan just slid to number four. They were three, but that's because of government incompetence. And you know, they were the Japan rebuilt society. We bombed where I am right now. We bombed every you know, miles and miles. Like Tokyo is a large prefecture. We bombed along the rail lines. We devastated everything, burnt everything down to the ground, and they rebuilt. And they have the capacity to do that. I think where we may see these citadels build out around the world, where now let me finish that point. Whenever you're, I just went back to the United States for the first time, basically since 2009, right? I've gone to Hawaii, but not to the continental United States, and I was prepared to be shocked by what I saw, right? Because I've heard so many bad things. I wasn't as shocked as I, maybe I was overprepared, but the sense of infrastructure, right? When you go to an airport, right? I flew into Dallas Airport. It's like, you know, it was designed in 19, built in 1960. There's no signs. You don't know how to get any. Everyone is walking around confused. Everybody there's a state employee. Now there are some people who are doing, you know, I stayed in the Hyatt there. People were very nice, very, you know, very, very cool, nice hotel. But in the public sector has just been beaten down. There's no vitality to it. When you travel, ironically, to through Incheon Airport in South Korea, where we conducted, you know, MacArthur, the Incheon landing, to cut off North Korean forces in on the peninsula, and then to turn the tide, so the story goes. You go to Incheon, it's, you know, very frequently voted the best airport in the world. It's just beautiful. You know, when you fly in Korean Airlines, and all the stewards are attractive, they're professional. They want to be working in those jobs, right? The same in Japan. The customer service in Japan is legendary. You know, you go to the bathrooms, the toilets, they're clean.
What
Their
what's that
economy is
what's that
screwed up.
cultural delta like? Because I understand, yeah. Because I was just telling my wife earlier today, literally about Japan. I was telling her we were talking, and you were in Japan, and I was like, man, they like, she has no idea what's going. Like, anything she knows about how crazy things are is mostly from me. She's raising some kids and doesn't really care about this stuff.
Good for her. Good for
Yeah,
her.
it's good to have one of us with our head in the sand, because otherwise we'd just be
She's on mission. That's right.
freaking
She's
out.
on mission.
But how is it that, like, my assumption in the United States to some degree has been a significant part of the cultural deterioration that I think anyone with half a brain sees is largely rooted in, I mean, it's the incentives, right? And I think the incentives are driven largely by really, really shitty money. Why is it that Japan has a similar, actually perhaps more dire, financial situation, don't have the global reserve currency, but they've maintained this culture.
Yeah, that's I'm sure people will find fault with anything that I say. I've spent 20 years here off and on. I'm married to Japanese. I don't know if that qualifies me for anything. One thing is that they are, and this is not a political statement, they're a homogeneous society,
Yeah.
right? There are
That,
no
that's it. Yeah.
Japanese, you know, there's
Yeah.
no diaspora around the, they've got Japan. And I know it's overblown how close they were throughout the centuries, but they relied on their own capabilities and their own intellect. And when you look back at Japanese history, the of course they imported culture, and a lot of that culture came from China. So their written script, the kanji characters, come from China. This idea of kind of the Confucian government system comes from China. The idea of organization, the way you organize your cities. The way you educate the elite, they still have that. So they kind of have somewhat of a caste system, right? Where you get the elites in the government go to the elite universities. They have this idea of senpai and kohai, which is, you know, if you're hired on Tuesday and I'm hired on Wednesday, you're the senpai, I'm the kohai. You get to tell me what to do. So it's very structured and regimented. I think also in their public school system, which can be a positive. Our kids went to Japanese Yochen. When they were young, and it they don't, you know, they're not addressing, you know, sexual identity or any of this stuff. You
Yeah.
know, they're teaching the kids to finger paint, and they're teaching the kids to go left and go right, and they're teaching the girls to wear pink, and they're teaching the boys to wear blue, and they're teaching them to participate in certain activities, to make artistic things, to sing songs, to clean up after themselves, to put the chairs on the tables when they leave. And I don't care if you see like the most rebellious Japanese with a tattoo and a, the Bosozoku, the guys who ride the motorcycles, you get them one-on-one, and they're gonna kind of be polite in that kind of societal way. So that really sets the tone. Then we sent them to U.S. government school on base for a military base for a little bit. And then I think around fifth grade or seventh grade, we took Max out to do homeschooling, and then afterwards we took the other boy out, I think in maybe third grade. That was over the corona stuff, the masks, you know, the implication that they had to, you know, take some sort of medical procedure, and it wasn't until that moment that I realized how important homeschooling is. But both my kids kind of have this a little bit of a regimentation to them, and they also get that they've done, both of them started jujitsu when they were like 5 or 6. And the older one has been doing it for a decade, so he's kind of getting, you know, dangerous.
Dangerous.
So it's kind of and you know, the street, when I think of how libertarianism could work without the overarching government of Japan, because, you know, when they went through the pandemic, they didn't have mandatory lockdowns, they didn't have mandatory vaccines, they didn't have mandatory mask wear. Now, 99.9% of the people wore the masks. I don't know what the uptake on the medication was, they did kind of a, when the government suggests things, the people normally follow. So it's voluntary, but it's a little bit coerced. So they restricted the hours in which pubs could operate or certain types of restaurants, et cetera, et cetera. So in Japan, a lot of times, and I found the same thing that Korea is. They'll do certain things to go along, even though they know that it doesn't really work. And maybe like 50% of them know that. Maybe, you know, 50% really think that the mask is going to work or whatever. But meanwhile, you know, people are wearing masks, they're going on public transit, and there are signs in there saying, make sure you sit close to each other to get as many people on the train as you can.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think from my observations, it's this idea that they do, it's very expensive here, for them, especially for Americans now, the exchange rate, it's great. But they do have this idea. I live in a nice little Japanese neighborhood, and it's quiet, it's peaceful. I don't think I've ever seen a cop in within maybe, there's maybe a Koban, which is a little Japanese station, maybe, I don't know, 500, 600 meters around the, whatever. I haven't seen a cop in a couple of miles, and since I've been living here for 4 years.
Wow.
And so there's no, you know, violence out in any part of Tokyo. I would never give you a warning, like not to go to a certain place at a certain time. It's
That is wild. I mean,
I mean,
that's
you could leave.
yeah.
I've left $10,000 worth of photo equipment in a bag on a train, got off the train, forgot I put it there. And I knew that by the time I got to the end station, they would have taken it down, they would have tagged it, they would have put it somewhere, and I'd have to provide some. The burden is now on me to prove that that bag belongs to me, but it ain't getting stolen. And they did the same thing. I left a hat on the train one time, and the guy made me pull out like three forms of ID to get my hat back. And so I just think there's this respect. And even though the Japanese government is in debt, and I know Japanese real wages haven't increased in like 20 years, so there are structural problems. If the government would just get out of the way, just like in the United States, if it stopped committing to expanding their defense capabilities because somehow they're scared China's gonna take over Japan, they really follow what the United States dictates to them to do in support of our alliance. If they distance themselves from that, I could see Bitcoin taking purchase here because there's 47 prefectures in Japan. I hope that's right, and they all have a matter of independence amongst them. So we saw that during the pandemic, and I'm part of this thing called Tokyo Citadel Builders, which I don't have any role. I'm a pleb. I just show up to the meetings. The leaders of this organized things. Last week, we actually went to a Lightning Network development, a Lightning Node development seminar downtown, and I took my 16-year-old with me. I know nothing about Lightning Nodes. I know, and it was mainly tech stuff. But what he and I have pledged to do is to throw ourselves into this, environment as much as we can, so that we get maybe a couple of kernels in our brain to understand how does that build out? And I found my son sitting there nodding. And afterwards, he said to me, it dawned on him that he's one of the very few people that speaks fluent Japanese, fluent English, and understands Bitcoin. And so on his, we homeschool, and I didn't assign him it on his own. We're taking one of his courses is Seyfedina Musa's Online Principles of Economics. So I think he's in 10th grade now, 10th or 11th. And on his own, he decided to order the Bitcoin standard in Japanese. And he's slowly, painfully making his way through that. So I know I kind of got off topic, but I think it shows us hope that there are going to be these, you can call them citadels or whatever. There are going to be places in the globe where Bitcoin finds a friendly purchase. That's going to build out. And Americans are going to realize when they eventually, it's like Singapore at the end of World War II. Why is Singapore a world economic power? It's a tiny city state. It's because the people there, same thing. They've got, they have their own ethnic divisions there, and Malays, Indians, Chinese, very smart, in incredible, banking system, and they built out this out of swampland, mangrove forest. They built this citadel, and if that can be done in the previous paradigm of government controlled currency, why can't that be the case with Bitcoin decentralized? Why can't El Salvador be a world power? And so, as far as the United States is concerned, I don't know where that's going to go.
Time will tell. Well, I think going back to the sort of the cultural, the cultural division between I'm going to say East and West, but I think Japan and it seems South Korea in particular are two places that, if I've ne never been to either, from my understanding, have this culture of respect. And I mean, the crime's low, like all of that. And you go to any major American city, there are pockets that you do not want to visit. I think you hit on one thing that's interesting, and that is, it's probably politically incorrect to say, but it's like this ethnic homogeneity. I mean, it's true. And I remember reading something about, like, well, how come socialism sort of kind of works in Sweden or other Scandinavian countries or whatever it was. And the author of the article was saying, well, they've got a few million people. I mean, first of all, it's a much smaller country than like the United States, and everyone's white and blonde and grew up in Sweden, and like they have this ethnic all these commonalities where everyone sort of kind of wants the same thing, at least on a level that's useful for running a society. You know, even if it's not exact, even what if I said, even if what I just said is not ex precisely true, it's close enough that you can go further. It's kind of like in a family, it's like I'm the head of our household, right? Like we don't have a democracy in my family. Like my kids don't get to call the shots or vote on everything that happens. Like if we're going on a family trip, I'm deciding that with my wife, and my kids may or may not have a say, right? So, but then the further you get away from that, obviously that becomes more and more challenging. I think some cultures are able to pull off that more societal organization because they are similar enough, more like a family to some degree. At least that's an observation that seems directionally correct to me, if it's not perfectly accurate. But the other thing too, I think is, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this. I think so. I'm a Christian, and so for I guess I would say, like, as a person of faith, I don't think shame is a useful tool, but as a society, I think shame is incredibly useful, right? Like in the United States, you're not allowed to say anything is bad, and you're not allowed to say that there are only two genders, and you can't hurt anyone's feelings. In my sense, and this is I think where I'm just on a rant, but this is sort of where my question comes in. My sense is that in Japan, for example, you don't want to shame your family. Like if you're the troublemaker, if you're the kid acting out in class, if you're whatever, like there's discipline, it's swift. You've embarrassed us. You don't do that ever again. And to me, that's like such a powerful, powerful tool that I think we've just gotten. And that's where I think where I'm struggling to understand is, like, why is the United States departed from that so far? And Japan's been able to retain it besides, maybe like ethnic homogeneity. So is that a semi-accurate characterization that in Japan, like, there is this sense of shame if you let down your family, if you act out, if you is that a true characterization?
That is. And, anytime you kind of venture in these discussions of, human beings, I'm always careful to point out that, Japanese are human and they have their own, frailties. They're not
Sure.
all uniform, that many are different, right? And some rebel, in an extreme manner. It doesn't seem to manifest itself too much in widespread violence or deterioration of the public sphere. And but you're exactly right about shame. So and it took a while for me to kind of wrap my head around, as I've spent time with my wife, who kind of guides me through understanding Japan in a way. And over the years, I mean, we had real not differences, but and there are still times once in a while where I just kind of make an American statement, and I'll say, "Well, I'm American, so I'm just not doing that." But for example, if somebody, the news here is as bad as it is anywhere else, right? They're not going to talk about, every once in a while they'll have a story on the yen to dollar ratio. They're not going to talk about how their central bank is corrupt. They're not going to put up any, government messages. There's basically Japan is basically run by a one party rule. So whether you want to call it representative democracy or whatever, it doesn't really exist here. And but there is this idea of, and you'll see stories, if somebody steals a bike in Tokyo and it's on video, that's going to be like a top story on the news. And then they'll show it over and over from every angle how the bike got stolen. Or if somebody, they'll show you things where, a guy overparked for a month in a parking area. And so, and then, and for some reason, they always blur out the person's face, but
They should. They should see.
it's
They shouldn't. They shouldn't. They should
they
just show the person's face, and then
I
no one
agree
will ever do it
100%.
again. Yeah.
That's right. And I do not want to be guilty of painting this place as a paradise, because there, you know, there is a
No, no.
downside to this mass conformity, right? So a perfect example is people always say, well, look, Japan is a peaceful country. The society's well disciplined. You're going to come here and you're not going to be subject to violence. Are they a free society? In my opinion, if you're not an armed citizenry, you can never truly be free.
Yeah.
And how do we explain that in the Japanese experience? They weren't armed during the period of World War II, when the government said you have to go and do the things that we require you to do. There's no tendency in the society, and there was no ability for an armed rebellion to
Right.
stop them from going and committing atrocities and doing whatever they did. So there is an enormous societal downside. In the future, if the government decides to become more tyrannical, if the people, like you said, you know, a lot of the people have their heads in their phones, they don't pay attention to what's going on. There's the potential for things to get a lot worse. If the government decides it's going to support the United States by changing Article 9 of their Constitution, which restricts them from, which we wrote after the war, and restricts them from sending military personnel, armed military personnel overseas, or participating in combined operations with other countries, they've begun the process in earnest, especially under Prime Minister, the late Prime Minister Abe, to give them a little bit more flexibility vis-a-vis cooperating with U.S. forces in the region to repel the regional threats that they identify as North Korea and China. And again, it's this just giving into this Western facade of this external threat, when really the major internal threats, or the threats to Japanese society, are internal, that come from the central government, that come from confiscatory taxes, overspending, the debt cycle, overregulation, the inability for members of society to you know, start their own businesses without extreme overregulation, or to be able to. I read something recently where I think the Japanese have some of the lowest wages, you know, per capita in the world. And so they have an amazing, you know, demographic problem, where they're not making babies, and they're not making babies because it's too damn expensive for
Yeah.
people to start a family and not live in a, if you want to live downtown close to your job, people live in a, you know, my wife's apartment when we met was as big as the room I'm sitting in, and this is basically a bedroom slash office.
Yeah.
And so now the white pill comes in. Are there opportunities in the future? Yes. You know, people may have opportunities to work more online. They could live out in Western Tokyo and the countryside, other prefectures, you know, such as Hiroshima. There's a big a foreigner settlement where people can come and buy these abandoned houses for fairly cheap, and have a little bit of land and start some sort of enterprise. But it's going to take a lot to get that going, because the society right now is based on, you know, moving to Tokyo, getting some sort of low-paying job, right? Getting your internet hooked up, and spending your, you know, a lot of your free time on your keita, on your cell phone. And it doesn't strike me as an environment to interact with other people and to produce lots of babies. A very similar problem, I think, in the United States, if we didn't have immigration. A similar problem in China. Similar problem in South Korea. And once again, what does it come back to? It comes back to this fiat currency, government control of all human activity. And it's just putting a cork in a society that otherwise would flourish. Because look, the Japanese population was exploding prior to World War II. And one of the reasons why they had to go further afield to get resources was to feed that growing population and to provide it with, you know, the industrial capacity to be able to grow into a power that would compete with the other imperial powers that were operating in the region. And so, yeah, so Japan's an interesting case. And one of the things that struck me about the United States when I went back, and one of the frustrations that I have, and it might not be indicative of everything, and maybe I'm on Twitter too much looking at it, but so I went to a weightlifting seminar in what was it, Wichita Falls, Texas. And I had been in that area before. Actually, the artillery school for the U.S. Army is in Lawton, Oklahoma, which is, you know, maybe like an hour north or so. And so I was just shocked at how decrepit the infrastructure was in this North Texas town. And then, you know, these billboards out there about all the kids who are dying on fentanyl. It struck me as, like I used to say before, aside from Iraq, the worst place I ever was at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. Lawton, Oklahoma, which is an army town outside the base. And so now that's my own particular bias because I'm from the Northeast where we've got ocean and mountains and forests and all this stuff. And I was plunked down in this place that prepared me well for the desert. And I was really shocked by this. It just seemed like, you know, if I could characterize it, you know, it'd be like, you know, like a 60-year-old beaten down, you know, drug addict man. That's what Wichita Falls represented to me. And however, we would go out to dinner at this local steakhouse, which was very good. And it's a chain, and it's a big chain in the United States. And you know, outside of it's packed. Parking lot is packed, right? All four-wheel drive trucks, you know, what is it, six wheel to the sixth wheel on there, right? Everybody in there is, you know, got their hat on and the cowboy boots, right? And then there was a one night we went there was a prom and all the people coming in there playing, you know, country music, and there's line dancing and all that stuff. And I was sitting in there, and it just struck me that's like a perfect metaphor for like the Biden universe and the Trump universe. And so outside you've got the, and it's unfair to put it on Biden, even though he is terrible. You know, the United States, the degradation of the United States middle class and its society and cities has been happening, you know, ever since the end of World War II. And but inside, all these people, right, you know, they have Trump bumper stickers and it's red, white, and blue and all that stuff. And I'm sure they support the blue and the military and all that stuff. But all those people inside, it was like Fort Apache, the Bronx. You know, it's like this refuge in there. And all those people in there did nothing to save the city outside that's a shithole today. Right. So you can celebrate and God, I stand up for the Pledge of Allegiance. What you can do, all that stuff. Samuel Johnson said patriotism is the last refuge of the scoundrel. Right. When that's all you have, right? When all you're gonna do is wave this and not read it, then you got nothing. And those people didn't stand up and demand more from their public schools, demand pushback on the LGBTQ agenda, demand wokeism, demand, you know, or demand a repulse to wokeism, lower taxes, more freedom. They weren't protesting in the streets every time we sent money to foreign power. They're not protesting the military industrial complex because there's an air base right down the road. And like you said, a lot of those boomers are benefiting from that situation. Hey, I'm good. I got my truck. I got my house. I'm retiring. I'm good to go. I'm going to watch the Trump speech tonight on wherever I watch such a thing. And I'm not going to lift a finger to defend that space. So my question is, what is America? You know, if those people aren't going to, and this gets back to the point that you were asking, how do we fight the fight for this independent society that's based on this decentralized currency? I think we have the same problem right now in American society, except for we have a solution called Bitcoin. And I did not answer your question, how do we convert the boomers?
Well, let's get to that in 1 second. So I guess I am guilty, as I think a lot of people are, of, you know, like it's very easy for me to say, okay, well, I'm gonna focus on my family, right? Like not even not on my city, like on not on my, you know, community at large. I'm gonna focus on my family. I'm gonna homeschool my kids. I'm gonna grow an orchard and raise chickens, and I'm gonna take care of myself and make sure that I'm ready for whatever comes my way. And like I feel a very strong sense of duty to my family to make sure that I love them and raise them and support them the best I can. But and I will never that will never change. I think what I think a lot about though is beyond that, what is my sense of duty that what's the sense of duty that I ought to have? And I think up to this point, like if there was a group of people, you know, waving signs and protesting in downtown St. Louis, where I live, because of all the nonsense that goes on, and we're one of the most dangerous, well, pockets are the most dangerous city in the world, or in the United States. Yeah, I think I would join that. No one's doing it, and so like, what am I gonna do? Go down there by myself and hold up a sign? Like, it's so unimpactful until you get like a critical mass of people. Same time, someone needs to be the first person to start waving a sign and marching and doing something about it. And so I guess it's like a chicken and egg problem, and I'm kind of stuck trying to figure out which comes first. And am I the chicken? Am I the chicken or the egg? And when do I start marching, you know?
Yeah, no, it's and that really is a conundrum. I think all of us, and especially since I just, pointed to the Declaration of Independence and said, these guys sacrificed everything to go, and I'm not. I'm comfortable. And like I said before, I'm not trying to be a hypocrite. I was in DOD for 36 years. I benefited from the fiat system. When I was in it, I told my kids, I'm a parasite. I'm a parasite, but I ended up on the right side of this fence. And that's the lot that I made. I didn't create this existence to be an independent entrepreneur. I didn't, I think what I did not do, and I think what you're kind of answering your own question now, and that maybe what led you into this podcast space, and I think it's something that is going to lead me into that space as well, is that you have this intellectual curiosity, you see these problems, you understand them, you've been compelled to get into this space to have these conversations that may help people that have the same problems. And I don't have the answers, but what I will say in that, and this is how I think, the citadels have to kind of work out in concentric circles as well. And it was something that I was going to conclude with, and we were actually going to begin with, is that I really think the only thing that you can control, right, is yourself and your family. And that's why, and that is that. That's your center of gravity. I wake up in the morning and I think about my family. And so, what are we going to do today? Like I said, we homeschool, but they're basically fire and forget. We do the Ron Paul curriculum with the boys, and then Seyfedina Moose's Principles of Economics. And then next year, we're going to see where that goes. That includes jujitsu that they do a couple times a week. They study Japanese a couple times a week, weightlifting, which I help coach them through. And I'm just trying to make sure that my family is as anti-fragile as they can be, right? That they're not going to have these problems, the problems that I had when I was growing up with, experimenting with drugs or drinking alcohol when you're young, or fooling around with girls and all that stuff. That's that I learned through that experience. I survived that and understood that when I was a parent, I didn't want that. And just like you may not only get weird looks because you're in this strange, orange-pilled environment, but when you tell your family or friends, whatever, that you're homeschooling, somehow they look at you like, you just said you're gonna, send your kids off to a North Korean gulag or something. Although they might prefer that to the, you taking the risk
Yeah.
of you. How can you teach anybody, anything? You
Yeah.
don't know. And so. And th that's why there's a part of me that thinks, and I don't know how to really think this thing out, is that there's a reason why when I go to, and I don't know, many of the folks closely in the Tokyo Bitcoin Citadel, but there's, when you go and you have a meetup, you're going to have genuine conversations with people. You might not agree on everything, but you're going to have a starting point of reality where you realize in 5 or 10 minutes, you have more in common with those people than you have with your siblings. And every one of them, if they're saying that, they might say, well, hey, I'm running a Lightning node or I'm running a Lightning wallet. And I'll be like, you know what? I don't spend much Bitcoin. I don't really, you have to walk me through this Lightning wallet thing. And then I may mention that I'm homeschooling. Oh man, I really want to homeschool, but my wife's not really into it. She's Japanese. She's more traditional. We kind of have to get over that hump and, hey, what do you want to drink? I'll have a Perrier. Oh, why? Yeah, well, I don't drink alcohol. Well, neither do I. Hey, you look pretty good. What do you do to eat? Well, I'm mainly carnivore and blah, blah, blah. What do you do to train? So
Yeah.
there's this aspect of, I think what we want is, and perhaps in your case, but certainly in my case, because like I said, I'm 59. I can lift more than my oldest child right now, and I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure that I am the alpha male as long as I can go, except for now, I'm kind of in a kettlebell phase. But when it comes to doing something for your mind, doing something for your body, right? Doing something for your spirit, you mentioned, Your religion, staying connected to God. And that's where all this kind of fire comes to. Look, we're a minority. You're a minority, man. Moses was wh how many his how many noble characters are there in the Bible, right? Not King David, right? Not Moses. You got one guy, Jesus, right? Out of all that stuff, all those power, everybody is flawed. We're all flawed. And that's this great challenge. I don't relish it. I wish I had more answers. How do you build this community out? The best thing I can say is just like what you're doing. When I hear people saying, and that was going to be my first question to you, because I heard you had kids on the other podcast. Are you homeschooling? And man, what a huge thing. What a gift that is, right? And that's why when I just recently left government under duress, I was basically forced out. They had a series of investigations on me to force me out of the paradigm, because I was identified as a guy who wasn't taking the medicine. I had disagreed with a lot of the policies in the command, so they created this multi-year kind of hostile environment to basically get me to the point where I made the decision where I was either gonna try to have a mountain of legal fee, pay off a mountain of legal fees to fight a defense to stay in this soul-sucking job, or whether it would occur to me that I work with psychopaths and that there's no reforming this enterprise. The Department of Defense is mainly psychos. It's a woke, non-focused, the $1 trillion a year that they get, none of that's spent on defense. They acquire weapons, but they're just wandering around the planet. If we had to go to, you watch, when a war develops, just like what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan, the first thing DOD does is they put their hands out and say, we're going to need a supplemental. We're going to need $35 billion just to get our forces there. Well, what am I giving you this $1 trillion for? I thought I was paying for that defense. No, you're not. No, that's just to pay everybody. That's just to build the ships. That's to pay off the contractors. That's to invest in these woke policies, right? That's what the enterprise is now, and that's draining resources from the United States. So really, until we get a handle on internally, like you're saying, would you go and protest in the streets? I don't. When I look at what happens in the United States, I don't think I would. But what I think I would do is. And I think the way this thing is going to go is the empire is over, right? The U.S. empire, we have forces in Japan and Korea and Middle East. And I'm going to write a piece for Mises where I line this out. Hopefully they'll accept it. It's basically a game plan. How do you scale down DOD? How do you get it basically down to nothing? And then how do you send certain resources to the states and have the states take over their own defense? So as a somewhere like Texas, they have more of a border security problem. So that they would develop, they don't need a large navy. They would just need border security and maybe some type of Coast Guard capability. The coastal states might have need more of some sort of naval defensive presence, but they can work that out. But the people who are going to be on the hook to pay for it are going to be the states at the state level. No federal taxes, no forces overseas. The thing is, this is ended. It's going to come to an end, and you either deal with it in a manageable way or you don't. And until we get to that point where the American people say, hey, look, I'm really not interested in Ukraine. I'm not interested in you, Israel. I'm interested in the border. I'm interested in the debt. I'm interested in crime. I'm interested if you insist on sending your kids to government school, which I think is a bad idea. But at least in our communities, we can control through the local school board the curriculum. We're not going to have any of this nonsense stuff that when we have, athletic competitions, there's going to be boys in one group and girls in the other at a local level, right? Where you have some sort of skin in the game. Until we get to that point, protesting in the streets against what's happening, what's occurring in the central government. You're going to protest in the streets right now because they just passed legislation for this anti-Semitism language, or they just appropriated billions of dollars to go overseas. And the problem is going to come to a head. I think it's going to end in nullification, where the states, and it may not just be a state, it might be a county, just like what happened during COVID. Hey, our sheriff's department is not going to enforce masking or lockdowns or any of that stuff in this county. And until we build out, you know, from our families, right? And I might be a, you know, you and a couple other families may live where you live, and you may let it be known, hey, we're building a citadel here. That might make me move there. And then maybe we run for councilman or whatever. I don't have the solution, but I think it's going to be a bottom-up movement, not a top-down movement.
Yeah, I like that. Well, hey, Darren, this has been one of the most enjoyable conversations, and we've gone a long time. So
yeah,
I think Sorry, let's man. No. This is great. I think this there's so much we didn't talk about that I think we could. I don't even know what the hell we did talk about. We just kind of talked about everything, which makes I think is what made it
yeah,
fun.
Yeah, it's kind
it
of just, conversation. Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly.
It just made like it's like we were just sitting around having a having a cup of coffee together, chatting. Let's plan on doing this again, like in a few months or something. I'd love to
sure.
get to some of the topics we didn't get to, but then also, Lord knows, over the next few months, we're going to have price action. We're going to have someone else go to jail. We're going to have attack, you know, Elizabeth yep. Warren will say something intelligent, about Bitcoin that we can have a laugh over.
Yes.
So let's plan on reconvening covering this. Last question for you, I guess, is any, and this is just more of a fun one, any price predictions or kind of next few months, year sort of thoughts on where we're going? Are we going to continue the then they fight you phase, or are some of these recent events just kind of random and spontaneous? What are you thinking?
Well, fortunately, like I said, as any good retired soldier, I binge listened to all your podcasts, so I knew it was coming. And I, you know, and I don't... And I know you know it's a difficult proposition. I don't want to come off as being cute, you know. Well, we don't pay attention to price because what it is yeah. it's a decentralized. You know, there's yeah. a way to be able to like try to be pedantic and to teach the lesson. Like once we disconnect the value of Bitcoin from the fiat system that no yeah. longer has this right. But like I said, I came into this as an investor. And so there's a part of me that thinks, hey, I want this thing to freaking, you know, God
rip,
candle.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we're like, then these conversations are like, you know, I try to reach out to you. You're like on your island, like that, whoever that was, that douche who was doing the anti-Bitcoin stuff on his, you know, the sunglasses. He was on his yacht.
And, oh, my gosh.
And he
yeah,
was talking
yeah.
about how much money he made on shit coins or something. But I don't know. I'm kind of in a questioning. I saw some posts by Stefan Lavera this morning. I saw some other stuff from, and I listened to Nico this morning who talked about, yesterday about the impacts of the Hong Kong ETF and, some other macro, things. And then his father had said something to him about, I think his father has some understanding on macro. And I kind of tend to look at it in those type of Lynn Alden type of terms without being really too cute in that we know that we are confident. We're not sure. I'm not. We're confident that we put our fiat money into this thing that we think is the best asset. And I'll use it as an asset, not store value or get into, you know, unit of account, means of exchange. That and what I personally did was when I got out of equities, I got the majority of my, you know, future is aligned with Bitcoin or Bitcoin centric enterprises like MicroStrategy, only because that's within a, you know, a tax protected vehicle where that has greater advantage. So psychologically, I'm aligned with this idea that it's number go up technology. And once people understand the scarcity, that this will start to take off. Right now, I do remind us or constantly remind ourselves it is early days because like when I went to that Bitcoin meetup, when I go look, 14 seems to be the number wherever I go somewhere is like 14 dudes, you know, and I went to this Bitcoin thing and I think it was a halving party. I was in St. Augustine, Florida, and maybe there were like 30 or 40 folks there and all, you know, somewhat aligned. I think by the end of the year, we are certainly up over the previous high. I've gotten a lot more, yeah, I'd say, 73, 70, somewhere around there. I've gotten a lot more conservative only because I think that the ETFs and stories like Samurai Wallet, the macro picture, what's going on in the new, and I think it might have been Nico this morning or somebody said, like, look at what gold price action has done as well. And look at what equities have done as well. So you're going to open up your Apple app, and it's going to show you that, most things have been trending down for the last couple of weeks anyway. And so I like to think, look, am I one of those guys that think this thing's going to go to a million plus per you damn Skippy? Yeah, I think that this is the thing. How long it's going to take, I don't know. By the end of the year, I used to say I was aligned with folks who said maybe 150,000, based on I'm not a guy that looks at hash rate. I'm not really an analyst that way. But I would say between, let's say 70, 73 and 150 by the end of this year. Once we get into the cycle, further down into the cycle, year two of the cycle, I think we'll be cooking.
I'll be anxious to see what I'm interested to find out here over the next decade is when we stop talking about cycles, right? Because I think at some point we reach something resembling enough of ma enough critical mass in terms of adoption that I think we lose a lot of that volatility, and it begins to serve as like a more like I believe it served well as a store of value, but more is a more stable store of value, like more predictable, which is going to be very important forever pricing things in Bitcoin. Like right now, and I think we're still a long ways off from a lot of that. But if we're at 1% global adoption, it's I mean there it's going to be tumultuous, like in terms of it, the purchasing value of Bitcoin. Once we get to 10% adoption, I think it's like I heard I can't remember what podcast it was. They were talking about gradually, then suddenly. And one of the guys, I think it was on Jesse Meyer's podcast, if you know him, he said, I think of it more as like gradually than exponentially. Like it's not that like overnight suddenly with hyper Bitcoinization, but it's like all of a sudden it becomes very apparent to more and more people. This isn't going away. Its value proposition is maybe more digestible. We experience enough pain, financial and economic pain that we are looking for an escape hatch. And so I'll be curious to see, is that this cycle? I don't think it probably is, but is it, the next cycle? It may be, we'll just have to see. We'll have to see how much pain we're experiencing between now and then. And I think that'll maybe help lead us to our answer.
Yeah, I agree with everything you said, and it's funny because, when I'm sure you've seen that clip from I think it was the Today Show, and Katie Couric and Brian Gumbel were talking about what is this email thing, what is this, what's this the internet, right? And
What is internet or something
what
like
is
that?
internet? Yeah, it's exactly right. And so I think just someday my kids are going to watch this and they're going to be like, what is this cycle thing? What is this halving thing? Why are you talking about the price? It's like, look, my life is in sats. And so, that's where we are. And I think, to close on a maybe a plug for the Bitcoin way is that look, I don't like parting with my Bitcoin. I'm more of a hodler than somebody who feels the need to go out and start, spreading the wealth on Lightning. Although I'm not averse to that, and I think everybody should have the capacity to do that. Bitcoin way, when you join, you pay in Bitcoin. And to me, that's that makes me smile. Now, it doesn't, make me smile when I see the, when I paid for it and then when it goes up. And but again, that's my own psychosis where I'm attaching it to fiat. When but what it's a statement about the Bitcoin way that I value the product that you present enough to part with something that I monetarily value most. So, and I think a lot of people, when they're deciding to go, and maybe we should, close on with that a little bit more. And I will certainly do this next time. Is when let's talk about, how do you get the boomer in the space? And it's going to certainly be services like the Bitcoin way, because with boomers they have the asset, right? You can walk them through. One of your folks can walk you through how to set up a like. Look, I was able to pay, from my wallet and bing, and it was received. What we used Zaprite for my last settlement. So I didn't know what Zaprite was before. but I'm getting this into the flow of how are things on Sparrow, how are things in the foundation, how are things, you know, run through the node where you can see it. It starts to make sense. It starts to build up. And I think the way to get more boomers into the space, boomers have the money. They don't have the technological expertise. I think the Bitcoin way is one of those platforms that just brings that together and is a perfect synergy. And if you can make me understand it, then and I'm about the dumbest guy in the space. If you can make me understand it, then job well done.
Yeah, no, well, thank you. And for listeners, that was not a paid plug, but I was a client before I started working with the Bitcoin way too, and I'd say
they
the
suck
same
you
thing.
In.
It's a good group, and to be fair, there are a lot of great companies doing important things and different things. I mean, self-custody, yeah, I don't think you're going to find a better option than us, but we need L2s, and we need to figure out as we sort of maximize the store of value use case in the coming years, how do we begin to exchange this more quickly at a lower cost? How do we get this in the hands of people who are most affected, but who don't have savings to buy a Bitcoin today? How do we create this, you know, an economy whereby Bitcoin is the way of expressing value? So we're on our way, but I think it'll be a fun ride. I know that it'll have its ups and downs, but in the meantime, Darren, hey, I can't thank you enough for coming on. Thank you for being a client of ours. We are, of course, so grateful for you. And I'm being serious. This has been one of the most enjoyable conversations I've had. Let's plan on reconvening in the next couple of months and doing it just a similar chat. And I have no idea what I'm going to call this episode, because we just sort of talked about kind of everything. There wasn't like a particular theme, but it's been a lot of fun, and I look forward to chatting again soon.
Same here, Michael. Thank you. I very much appreciate it. It's a pleasure meeting you. I look
you
forward
bet.
To the next time.
Take care, Darren. And that's a wrap. Again, I hope you enjoyed the conversation with Darren. He was one of the most pleasant people I've ever talked to. Had a great conversation, and we had just met as we jumped onto that call. So the rapport was nearly instant, as it is oftentimes with Bitcoiners. Would encourage you to check out Darren. Keep an eye on the things he's working on. He is hoping to get more actively involved, perhaps start his own podcast, write a bit more now that he is retired and has flexibility, and appreciate the work he's trying to do for an older generation of Bitcoiners with boomers. Of course, if you need help with self-custody of your Bitcoin, check out The Bitcoin Way. You can follow us on X at TheBitcoinWay_, or go to TheBitcoinWay.com/podcast to schedule a free consultation. Follow me on X as well if you're interested. It's at TheOtherMJordan, and you can get my weekly newsletter where I just break down some of the basics of Bitcoin. It's blackhatbitcoin.substack.com. Until next time, this is Michael Jordan signing off.